I personally see nuclear energy as akin to, you know, jet plane travel. It's a highly dangerous undertaking done in the safest way possible. And with great power comes spectacular disasters. But also with experience comes increasingly safe and affordable technology.
The Rational View is a weekly series hosted by me, Dr. Alan Scott, providing a rational, evidence-based perspective on important societal issues.
Produced by Soapbox Media.
The world needs evidence-based public policy now more than ever. Making the right decisions should not be partisan politics. Please help spread The Rational View by going to patron.podbean.com/The Rational View. Together, we can make a better future.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Rational View. I'm your host, Dr. Al Scott. On this episode, I want to talk a little bit about nuclear energy and some of the perceptions of nuclear energy and even the anti-nuclear movement. And this was all catalyzed by a post that I saw from Oscar Martin on LinkedIn, that many people in Europe and the US believe nuclear energy produces moderate or high levels of carbon emissions. So I'd like to dig into that a little bit and give you some of my perspective, maybe help you get a rational view. If you like what you're hearing, please press like on your podcast app and share it with your friends. Love to talk to you on our Facebook group, The Rational View. So the post in question stated the following: nuclear energy is facing a severe challenge from decades of misinformation and indoctrination campaigns in the European Union, the United States. And these campaigns have distorted the public perception of nuclear energy, especially in Spain, where 58% of the population incorrectly believes that nuclear energy emits CO2. Nuclear energy is also unfairly criticized for its radiation effects and safety, despite being the safest of all energy sources in terms of deaths per terawatt hour. The truth is that the nuclear energy life cycle has the lowest carbon footprint, 10 times lower than polysilicon solar PV, the most common solar technology. Nuclear energy has proven to be reliable, resilient, and efficient in meeting the world's energy needs while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and air pollution. Nuclear energy deserves more support and recognition from the media, the public, the educational system, and the policymakers. So what was wrong with this? There was nothing really wrong with this post. It was actually met with a lot of questions and disbelief. In fact, who was misinforming the public about nuclear and why? Well, I'm here to tell you from my understanding where this comes from. So the who is kind of obvious. The oil industry, of course, has long waged war against the use of nuclear power and as an existential threat, really, to their business as usual. The evidence is somewhat overwhelming. Nuclear energy supplies the same role in the energy grid that fossil fuel burning produces. It's a reliable baseload thermal supply that can be turned on and off to suit the needs of the grid. Now, nuclear energy, what it doesn't do is it doesn't supply, at this point, heat to heavy industry, like coal burning and coke furnaces and these sorts of things. Although we're going to have to get there if we want to remove fossil fuel burning from the climate risk from fossil fuel burning and carbon dioxide. So what's the evidence that the oil industry is actually against nuclear energy? Now, this actually comes as a surprise to many people. Many people say, no, you nuclear lovers are also oil lovers. Well, that's not the case, not the case at all. Many of us are environmentalists trying to get rid of fossil fuels, trying to minimize our carbon footprints. So in 1970, Oscar tells us that a leader of the petroleum industry and the head of the Atlantic Richfield Company named Robert O. Anderson contributed $1.4 million, inflation adjusted, to fund the original Friends of the Earth, an organization that is strident in its opposition to nuclear energy, citing both safety and cost issues. The tight linkage between environmental groups and anti-nuclear groups, though, can be traced directly to the need for the oil and gas industry to discourage the use of nuclear energy back in the 70s. What other evidence is there? Well, from my long period of time looking at this, I found that the World Wildlife Fund, that, you know, supposedly a very reputable scientific organization, the World Wildlife Fund used to provide an annual climate scorecard by country. And if you look, their aggregation methods section included the following statement. Now, brace yourself, sit down if you have to, because you're not going to believe this, but the statement is as follows. WWF does not consider nuclear power as a viable policy option due to its costs, radiotoxic emissions, safety, and proliferation impacts. In this report, focusing on climate policies, a policy approach that favors the use of nuclear power is hence adjusted. The indicators emissions per capita, emissions per GDP, and carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour are readjusted as if the generation of electricity from nuclear power had produced 350 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour, the emission factor for natural gas. Therefore, a country using nuclear energy is rated as a country using gas, the most efficient fossil fuel. So, get this straight. Instead of using the actual emission factors of nuclear energy, they used natural gas. So instead of the IPCC's accepted value of 10 to 12 grams from 2014, or the more recent UNECE's assessment of 4 grams per kilowatt hour, they were using 350 grams of CO2 per kilowatt hour for nuclear, saying it's as bad as gas. So these awestruck people are wondering who would lie about nuclear energy emitting carbon. Well, the World Wildlife Foundation. And what this meant is that France came in third in the WWF climate scorecard ranking rather than first, as they would otherwise have been due to their clean nuclear grid. And we wonder why environmentalists are anti-nuclear. With this sort of misleading crap being pushed out by supposedly reputable organizations. But what is the motivation? And this is what gets me, is like, why are they doing this? The WWF claims they lied about emissions because they don't like nuclear energy. It's too costly. Well, why do we think it's too costly? Lazard, a financial group in the U.S., have been publishing an LCOE report, Levelized Cost of Energy, for many years, suggesting that nuclear energy is much more costly to build than other energy sources. And this is true, in the U.S. at least. Their data are based on recent U.S. builds, the Vogtle plant in Georgia being really the only one. And it went way over budget. It was delayed for many years when the main primary contractor went bankrupt and had to be replaced mid-build. It was delayed by changes in build regulations due to the Fukushima meltdowns. So this is what Lazard's levelized cost of energy is based on, is this over-budget, poorly managed fiasco where the primary contractor went broke and a new contractor had to pick up the pieces and finish. And now it's come online, it's come on grid, and it's actually producing power relatively cheaply, and you know, it's not going to be a fiasco for the taxpayers, for the ratepayers. It's going to be cheap. Nuclear-based grids like Ontario and France have cheap power compared to areas that are shutting down their nuclear plants and replacing them with supposedly cheaper options, like, for example, renewable energy, like wind and solar. Now, there's nothing to say there's wrong about wind and solar. It's very cheap to build, but the problem is that at a grid level, nuclear is reliable and has a high capacity factor and therefore needs less backup. And it's localized and dense and extremely high density. So it doesn't need nearly as much materials. It doesn't need nearly as much land. It doesn't need nearly as much roads. It doesn't need nearly as much ecological impact. It doesn't need nearly as much transmission lines. The costs to firm low capacity factor energy sources with peaking gas plants means that nuclear grids come out to be cheaper. This has been verified by study after study. Poland and the Netherlands have both studied this and published. They're publicly available, these studies on the cost of new energy, and they've concluded that new nuclear would be cheaper in the long run. Some of the factors involved are the lifetime of nuclear being much longer. Nuclear plants have lifetimes, 80 plus years. This is not typically accounted for when you do present cost analysis. If you know anything about present cost analyses, like the value of spending a dollar today to get production in the future is not as good as getting something right away. And this is what present cost analysis does. It discounts future benefits. So a typical analysis chooses a relatively high depreciation rate such that it devalues the energy production such that anything produced beyond the 20-year lifetime of variable sources is valued at zero. So if you're going to value the 80-year lifetime of a nuclear plant at zero, it's not going to look as nice in the economical landscape as building short-term wind and solar. What are the other complaints that WWF brings forward? Well, radiotoxic emissions, safety. Are these really reasons to discount nuclear as a non-viable policy option? On a straightforward corpses per kilowatt hour metric, nuclear is the clear winner amongst all energy sources. Now, you may think, solar energy is better. Well, people die installing solar panels. They fall off the roof. People are dying falling off of windmills. People are dying from dam failures. The Bankyo dam failure in China in the 1970s killed hundreds of thousands. Methyl mercury, neurotoxic emissions from hydro dams don't get near as much airplay or cause nearly as much fear as potential radioactive releases from nuclear power plants. Why do we have this unlevel playing field, this radiophobia? Why the irrational focus on nuclear's few deaths? These distorted perceptions do not really tell us, however, why groups that claim to be defending the climate and claim to support science, why are these groups against nuclear power? The why is very interesting. And to figure it out, I'm going to give you a bit of a history lesson. And I'm indebted to various sources on the internet for pulling this together, especially Judy Pageau's 2015 article in the journal Energy, Sustainability, and Society entitled Danger Explodes, Space Implodes, The Evolution of the Environmental Discourse on Nuclear Waste, 1945 to 1969. In this paper, she's gone through several newspaper articles to track the course of public opinion on nuclear power. Now, from my understanding, many anti-nuclear groups got their start protesting nuclear weapons. And a lot of the nuclear power hatred is just a carryover from an association with the word nuclear between weapons and power. If you've watched the recent Oppenheimer movie, you would know that the first nuclear device was detonated by the United States in New Mexico on July 16, 1945, at a site later named Trinity. Now, the U.S. actually, after this, conducted over 1,000 nuclear weapons tests between 1945 and 1992, including 216 atmospheric bomb explosions. They even exploded 5 nuclear weapons in space just to see what would happen. And all of these create radioactive fallout, which spreads around the globe and can increase. This is now a radioactive level in the strata. For future geologists, they're going to say, what the heck happened, if they go back and measure the radiation in this level? Because all of the fallout from these nuclear weapons is measurable, and it's going to last a long time from some of the long-lived isotopes. Between all of the countries doing tests, there were over 500 atmospheric nuclear weapons tests around the world up to 1980. Continued testing of atomic and then hydrogen bombs led to a rising concern about the effects of radioactive fallout, and even tiny amounts of radiation are very easy to measure with modern equipment. And it was accumulating worldwide at an alarming rate. And of course, the accumulation of weapons across the world is not a good thing. A lot of people were against this, and this is, a good fight to be involved in, is to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And at the same time, nuclear power was just in its infancy. So we have the U.S. and Soviet defense departments madly building nuclear weapons and enriching uranium and creating barrels of liquid high radiation waste. And they weren't doing a responsible job of disposing of it, while early researchers were looking at ways to harness the power of the atom in power reactors and to make isotopes for medical. And, you know, waste was treated differently back then. You know, if any of you watch Mad Men, I recall the scene where they were having a picnic on a beautiful hillside, him and the main character and the lady. And shockingly, at the end of this, he stands up, picks up the picnic blanket with a flourish, leaving all the utensils and paper plates and cups to flutter away in the breeze. And this is what it was like. I mean, nature was a limitless area. We didn't feel that, you know, we could pollute it. It was like a limitless dumping zone. And this was the perspective up until the 1970s, until the environmental protection agencies came into being and people started realizing that nature was filling up. It's not endless. We actually can make a difference to nature. And this wasn't a common understanding. So, you know, initial highly radioactive liquid wastes from refinement of plutonium and manufacture of weapons were sealed into barrels and dumped into the ocean on the prevailing thought of the times, that the solution for pollution is dilution. And if one or two barrels burst open and failed, so what? The ocean is limitless and full of natural radioactivity anyways. If a little plutonium leaks into the ocean, it's only going to be a localized problem, and eventually it will fade away as radioactivity does. But this mindset rapidly evolved. As I mentioned, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency concerns of radiation from waste entering the food chain were evident in news stories as early as 1950. And by the mid-50s, several scientists were speaking out about the unknown impacts of dumping radioactive waste into the ocean, which responsibly they should, and the risk of bioaccumulation of particular isotopes such as radioactive strontium-90 that chemically can replace calcium in the bones and cause bone cancer. And this was publicly discussed, and people were starting to say, well, maybe there's a risk here. Maybe we should be a little careful. And so, to give you a flavor of the news, August 7th, 1950, a news item describes disposal at the Brookhaven National Laboratory in Long Island. Radioactive material is collected in small tanks after it goes into the drains. If it cools off, it goes on into the sewers. Any accidental seepage can be detected quickly. Gas used to cool off the atomic pile is highly diluted before being released into the air. As we now know, discussion around nuclear waste has evolved significantly, whereas now all of the radiation is accounted for and kept stored in sealed containers, whereas the fossil fuel industry did not evolve as much, and it continues to use dilution in the commons as its solution to dispose of its massive hazardous wastes. And this has led to a big problem. This has led to climate change. This has led to particulate pollution. This has led to vast tailings ponds. In January 1956, the New York Times commented regarding the British dumping of 1,500 tons of radioactive waste in the Atlantic Ocean that, quote, elaborate precautions were taken to assure the waste containers do not disintegrate until their contents have become harmless. On September 18th, readers were reminded of the consignment of 1,500 tons that was dropped into the sea last January. And we're now to learn that during the operation, one container fell from a derrick with the result that the outer concrete casing broke. So, you know, this is not something that was treated with fear and radiophobia at the time, but it was starting to be concerning. By 1957, the public discussion had turned to safety from excitement. And on July 13th of that year, a news report noted that a tanker carrying a load of radioactive sodium waste down the Hudson River en route to a dumping point 150 miles southeast of New York is expected to pass under the George Washington Bridge today. And then later on July 15th, readers learned that an accident had befallen the shipment. One of about 25 yellow airtight receptacles dumped into the ocean had failed to sink. And it was actual news this time. and the lengthy report announced with alarm that a steel container filled with radioactive sodium waste is floating somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, about 185 miles southeast of New York, and is a nuisance to navigation. So you can see how the discussion is starting to change, and people are starting to become aware of the problems of radioactive waste. But remember, most of the waste at this point is from weapons manufacturing. It's not from civilian nuclear energy. Civilian nuclear energy really didn't come into its own until the 60s. And most of the reactors in the 50s were experimental and, you know, didn't have good safety precautions in place, didn't have good waste disposal in place. So obviously there's going to be a lot of bad stories, right? This is going to happen. The scientific community was looking for solutions. On March 12, 1957, it was reported that the 1957 Nuclear Congress, supported by 24 scientific and engineering societies, were addressing the dangers to the public from the spread of the atomic energy industry. So now it's highlighted in the news that there are dangers to the public. And the article highlighted the need for protection from the long radioactive life of some of the wastes into the hundreds of years. And this is reasonable and rational and reliable. You know, the gamma ray emitters, the dangerous stuff that can radioactively hurt you is mostly gone after a few hundred years. And at this point, you know, they've identified the issue and the need for isolation for a reasonable period. And this is not, you know, out of the ordinary with industrial waste. We commonly deal with toxic wastes that are toxic forever, arsenic and lead and mercury. And these things are buried and left to rot in subterranean caverns. And the same thing is planned for nuclear, but it gets a lot more of a focus for some reason. In 1959, a joint congressional subcommittee warned that high-level waste is so dangerous that experts have not yet decided whether it would be safe to cast it 150 miles offshore into 1,000 fathoms of water and leave it there. So at this point, people are still considering the possibility of dumping it in the ocean. But the discussion evolves, and eventually they come to the idea that we're going to put this in geological formations that are stable over geological time. And that makes perfect sense. And then, of course, the discussion got derailed by politics, and it didn't happen in the U.S. The Yucca Mountain site was chosen based on politics and not based on geology, whereas the deep salt deposits, like the WIP facility where they put the defense nuclear waste, are ideal for storing nuclear waste for millennia. The Yucca Mountain was a fractured geological site, and it was chosen on the basis of politics, not science. And you can listen to my interview with Jim Konka to learn more about that, or my What About the Waste podcast, where I go into some detail discussing these issues. So in October 1960, the French Atomic Energy Commission announced its intention to sink 6,500 barrels of atomic waste in the sea between Antibes and Corsica October 20th. Now, opposition was fierce at this point. People were becoming aware and were angry about the pollution. And a general strike was threatened, causing the government to reconsider, and they decided against this. However, the French atomic governing body took a dismissive view of protesters, referring to the campaigners as persons who, lacking sufficient information, are currently expressing their fears. So you can see it wasn't handled well from the start, and this is not unexpected, but the protesters' views did not evolve. The industry was forced to evolve by the public outcry. So the public outcry was reasonable at this point. I think the pollution needed to be stopped, and various safeguards were put in place. Now here's an interesting one. In November 16th, 1960, the accidental death of a nuclear scientist at Shirley, Long Island was announced when a huge truck loaded with used atomic reactor fuel skidded on wet pavement and struck his car. The headline read, "Car is struck by truck full of reactive waste. None leaks or spills." So it shows that the death of a scientist was overshadowed by the fear of a radioactive spill. So this shows how public opinion has become polarized even at this point. You know, somebody died, but that's okay because no radiation spilled. And interestingly, This does show, contrary to popular opinion, there has been at least one death from civilian nuclear waste. However, the death was actually caused by the weight of the safety containment features and not the radioactivity itself. So you could say that the safety program surrounding nuclear waste has killed more people than the nuclear waste. A little bit tongue-in-cheek there. So scientists and citizens of that era were fighting the good fight against the evils of polluting the commons. And this is a problem with everything that was going on back in that period. All of the chemical industries were polluting the commons. Rivers and lakes were dead. One river in Detroit caught fire from dumping, right? This was commonplace and needed to be stopped. The proliferation from nuclear weapons coincided with a rise in public concern about nuclear fallout debris contaminating food sources, particularly the threat of high levels of strontium-90 in milk, as it, you know, replaces calcium. Strontium and cesium are elements that have highly radioactive isotopes that can bioaccumulate in the body and have relatively long life half-lives, 30 years. So every 30 years, they have their radioactivity. So after a few hundred years, the threat of cancer from their radiation becomes negligible. Because they have this short life half-life, they're extremely radioactive. So these are the things that you need to protect yourself from, and the food chain from, and the environment from. The longer-lived radioisotopes break down much more slowly, and so they're not as radioactive. They're not dangerous. You can hold them in your hand, and you're not going to be at risk. Now, because of the risks, though, of strontium-90 building up in the environment, a scientist and citizen-led campaign publicized the significant buildup of strontium-90 in bones of babies. This is measurable because we can measure single atoms breaking down, even though, you know, thousands of atoms are breaking down in our body every minute. Single atoms are measurable in the bones of babies, and we can identify strontium-90 from nuclear fallout. And it helped galvanize public support for a ban on atmospheric nuclear testing in the U.S. And widespread anti-nuclear protests were organized, and Nobel Peace Prize laureate and theologian Albert Schweitzer led these things. His appeals were endorsed by the Pope and Linus Pauling, a physicist, who actually organized an anti-test petition signed by more than 9,000 scientists across 43 countries, including Albert Einstein. So, you know, scientists were galvanized behind stopping the proliferation of weapons and the spreading of nuclear fallout from weapons testing. Now, if you've watched Oppenheimer, you might have remember the name Edward Teller, who's the father of the hydrogen bomb. He was amongst a minority of scientists who claimed that the fallout and dose rates accumulating from these tests was fairly harmless. And that's true. He is correct. But this is one of those risks that people are not taking willingly. So for risks that you don't take on willingly, you want to have a relatively high level of safety. And you don't want the government to be telling you that you have to do this. You don't have to take on this level of risk. So the baby teeth really won the day. And meanwhile, there were reports of leaking waste from early research reactors and meltdowns here and there, the Chalk River meltdown in 1952, various accidents. And, you know, this news is alongside stories of airborne nuclear fallout ending up in baby teeth. I suspect that scientists and engineers against anti-nuclear protests, because most of them were also against the proliferation of nuclear weapons and open-air testing. So they didn't speak out against these things because they were on board with the end goal of getting rid of the nuclear weapons or slowing down the expansion of nuclear arsenals and proliferation. So there was a lot of negotiations, and eventually a test ban treaty went into force October 10th, 1963, prohibiting nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere and outer space and under the water. Following this success, the nuclear industry and government agencies, I think, seem to have adopted a strategy of downplaying the risks of nuclear waste and authoritatively telling the public that the health dangers of spent nuclear fuel were overblown. And yes, they're correct, but the public perception is what they didn't understand, and the fear that had been building. In December 1967, for example, Reuters News marked several months of delay in informing the readers of previous summer's dumping in the East Atlantic of 11,000 tons of solid radioactive waste. And it quoted the European Nuclear Energy Agency in giving assurance that the dumping would represent no risk either to man or marine organisms. So you can see how the nuclear agencies and the government organizations tasked with disposing of this were being pushed from away from their easy dumping in the ocean to being a little bit more safety conscious by the public, by protests. And this was, you know, this was a good result. This happened. Nuclear is much safer now than it was. And in the early 1970s were the first large protests against nuclear power in Germany, in Wiel, West Germany. The project, the reactor project was canceled eventually in 1975, and the anti-nuclear success at Wiel inspired opposition to nuclear power all over the globe. But why did this happen? Why was nuclear power suddenly vilified? People were still, you know, pro-nuclear power. They were building and they were getting low-cost energy. It was too cheap to meter. Electricity prices were very low. And part of this was because safety was not being taken care of. Part of this was because there were not enough backups in place. And we saw this at Chernobyl. We saw this at Three Mile Island. There was not enough training. There was not enough safety culture. The anti-nuclear energy movement was born in the wine-growing region of the Black Forest, abutting the borders of Switzerland and France's Alsace-Lorraine. There, in the tiny hamlet of Ville, the area's staunchly conservative farmers, joined by left-wing activists from the nearby university city of Freiburg, as well as concerned French and Swiss citizens, organized to stop the construction of a planned reactor. And initially, the farmers' objection was that the steam clouds from the reactor's cooling towers would block the sunlight in their vineyards, and not anything to do with radioactivity as a hazard. Somehow this mishmash of left and right protesters caught on and became a cohesive anti-nuclear juggernaut, bound together by the spirit of successful local action. And in Germany, one key figure was Klaus Traub, who held top managerial positions in West German and U.S. nuclear installations and provided an air of scientific validity to these protests. He had witnessed an accident in a German reactor caused by a minor human error and became dubious of the anti-nuclear movement and his party, the Social Democrats, with a semblance of scientific virtue while vilifying the dangers of nuclear power. And he was proven right to an extent. There was a risk and a lack of safety culture in the Soviet Union, especially, which Chernobyl played out. But even considering this risk, and even considering Chernobyl and Fukushima and Three Mile Island, nuclear power is still the safest power source around if you measure it in corpses per kilowatt hour due to its immense energy density. So this is where we're at. Although opinion polls in the 1950s and 60s showed remarkably high approval of nuclear power, and the majority of opinion favored nuclear energy, surveys conducted through the mid-1970s showed rapid declines in support from about 1975 onward. After the successful protest in Germany, a protest against nuclear power occurred in Spain in 1977 with up to 200,000 people in attendance. So people were beginning to feel like, you know, we've shut down nuclear testing. We're getting rid of nuclear waste. We need to get rid of nuclear power. They moved on. And with their power, they unfortunately were able to be successful. And in 1979, there was the unfortunate partial meltdown accident at Three Mile Island, the same week that Hollywood came out with the China Syndrome movie, which portrayed a nuclear sabotage incident or a terrorist incident at a nuclear facility. And this prompted many good weapons protesters to turn on nuclear energy despite its immense promise. And you know, this I would say is maybe one of the turning points in the war that the oil industry used to their advantage, because they were seeing their share of energy drop because of the oil crisis. But suddenly demand for electricity dropped. There was flagging need for new nuclear power around the same time, new nuclear plants, and protests were increasing. And, you know, in 1981, Germany had its largest anti-nuclear power demonstration at the Brockdorf nuclear power plant west of Hamburg with 100,000 people. And, you know, there were changes to culture that came about because of the accidents. And as we learn more about how to store the energy, and as public opinion changed about how to store wastes. In 1983, Germany started storing its spent nuclear fuel in dry casks, capable of safely isolating the waste for about 50 years, enough time to build a geological storage facility, for example. However, then in 1986 came the Chernobyl disaster. And in May of that year, something like 200,000 people marched in Rome to protest against the Italian nuclear program. And it was in 1986 as well when the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission first licensed its dry cask storage for spent civilian nuclear fuel. If you want more information on nuclear fuel storage and the risks or lack of them from the waste, please see my podcast episode, What About the Waste? So from about this time, 86 forward, spent nuclear fuel has always been stored safely, mostly on site where it's produced, because there's not so much of it being produced. It's very high energy density, thousands, millions of times more dense than coal. But fueled by these accidents, these high-profile, high-publicity accidents and the Hollywood movie Chernobyl disaster, the anti-nuclear power movement mobilized political and economic forces, which for some years made nuclear energy completely untenable in many countries. And there were Austrians written into the constitution that thou shalt not have nuclear power. Germany has got a huge movement. Italy is not allowed. Spain has been anti-nuclear for some time. In the U.S., public opposition preceded the shutdown of the Shoreham, Yankee Row, Millstone 1, Rancho Seco, Maine Yankee, and many other nuclear power plants. And activist politicians banned their nuclear energy in many states, in Illinois especially. We just had a governor try to veto overturning this bill that would allow nuclear power to be built again. You know, in deference to the shrill cries of the mob, anti-nuclear voices took over regulatory agencies, while non-government organizations like Greenpeace advocated active sabotage against nuclear facilities and tried to implement it. So the public opinion just turned sour. And, you know, for good reason, people were suspicious of government saying, no, it's not dangerous, right? Who do you trust again? This is the basic question of building trust in the facts and in the purveyors of facts. So, it must have been around the early 1980s when they changed the name of nuclear magnetic imaging systems in hospitals to magnetic resonance imagers. So it went from NMR to MRI. They dropped the word nuclear to avoid causing fear in the patients, even though it has nothing to do with radiation. It's just magnetic fields. It's resonating the nuclei in their cells to make images. But because it was called nuclear magnetic imaging, they had to change it so that the people wouldn't be scared. For scientists, I feel it was difficult to argue at that time with such a huge groundswell of anger, the benefits of nuclear power against, you know, deserving anger in some cases, accepted low levels of radiation from nuclear fallout as a valid argument against testing of nuclear weapons. And, you know, it would be hypocritical to now stand up and suggest that it wasn't really as dangerous as we said. But, you know, there was some danger. And I believe this shows the power of local action and the immense inertia of popular movements when the people start to see they're making change. And it also shows it's difficult to make a nuanced argument in a politically polarizing situation. That's one reason I have this podcast, is that it's very difficult to see the facts for the anger. And these protesters felt they were making a positive difference in getting rid of nuclear energy. They didn't pause to think that they were throwing the baby out with the bathwater and dooming their descendants to decades of fossil fuel pollution and climate change. They just didn't trust the establishment, and that was, they had good reasons. I personally see nuclear energy as akin to, you know, jet plane travel. It's a highly dangerous undertaking done in the safest way possible. And with great power comes spectacular disasters, but also with experience comes increasingly safe and affordable technology. And the nuclear disasters that have happened have not killed us all. We're still here. You know, the Chalk River meltdown in 1952, Ottawa is still there. People still live there. It's not killing us. We need to have a rational view of the dose and the toxin. And I still believe that we can get to a Star Trek future if we can just keep a rational view. Thanks for listening.
If you'd like to follow up with more in-depth discussions, please come find us on Facebook at The Rational View and join our discussion group. If you like what you're hearing, please consider visiting my Patreon page at patron.podbean.com/The Rational View. Thanks for listening.